CliffCentral.com.
We're excited this morning because the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's, one of our most favorite weekly endeavors. We get to check in with some of the smart people, some of the people who really are paying attention to all the news stories, and hopefully they help us to condense it, make sense of it. And therefore, when we're asked an uncomfortable question at the coffee machine at work, we can go, ah, but I know this. So Tim Cohen is the senior editor at Business Day. And he began his journalism career in Dome Newspaper, the official student newspaper of the University of KwaZulu-Natal. He graduated to the last outpost, the Natal Witness, fueled by tea, where he subsequently was lured to the coffee-infused domain of Business Day. On Business Day, he's been the political correspondent, finance editor, London correspondent, and editor-at-large, among many other posts. And he says it was probably the coffee, but I think it's because he knows what he's doing. So, Tim, it's a pleasure to speak to you this morning. And Dumi Morake is here with us this morning, too. This is brought to you by Nando's. Tim Cohen, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Cliff. Thanks very much to be here.
Good. So, listen, Tim, a couple of things that are going on that we need to hear your thoughts on. The latest on the SAA saga is as good a place as any to start. Is SAA still running? I mean, I don't even know if we're still in business here. What's going on?
Yeah, no, they've well, they got another 5 billion rand in the medium-term budget. It is extraordinary. It is amazing how an organization can lose so much money so fast. I mean, how do you do that? It's incredible. You know, I did a piece for the Financial Mail this week, and I had a look at the profitability of airlines all around the world. One of the strange things about SAA is that that actually these are weirdly good times for airlines. You know, for the international airline industry, they made a record profit last year, around about $13 billion collectively. This is the entire industry. There was once a time that all of the airlines, you know, that airlines had this reputation of being businesses that really just couldn't make money.
Yeah, I remember late 90s, early 2000s, people were saying this is a bad business, let's get out of it.
Yeah, no, that's right. And all of the top three, the big three legacy airlines in America, American Airlines, United, and Delta, all three of them went bankrupt in that period. But now they are, you know, the most profitable airlines in the world. It's, and the part of the reason for that, apparently, well, there's lots of reasons for that. First of all, they bought more airplanes. The total number of trips made by airlines is exploding.
If you think about it, more and more people are flying than ever before, and it's become cheaper in some places because they've got these planes. How many planes does SAA have at the moment? Do we know?
Yes, I'm just from memory about 200. If I I'm not sure about that, but I think that's about right. Yeah, it's a lot of planes. That's including SAA Express, which does sort of little local hops. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about SAA is that you know, sort of typical of government enterprises, they have just staffed up to the gills. So there are apparently around about twice as many people staffing every plane in SAA than the international norm, which is quite incredible.
Yeah, we've got like the highest ratio of people to planes in any airline in the world.
Yeah, that's right. And just to go back to the international sort of context, apparently one of the other reasons why planes are making more money is the obvious, less knee room.
Yeah.
They're just squeezing more and more people onto every individual flight. And it's uncomfortable and unpleasant, but the airlines are coining it.
Yeah, and sometimes I book on SAA and then I end up on Mango somehow, which, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they have these strange things. You book, if you're flying internationally, you can book on one airline, and then when you walk onto the plane,
yeah,
actually it's a different plane. Actually, that's one of the SAA problems, is that because it's in a difficult, desperate financial position, it's willing to take overflow from the other airlines. So the other airlines now book like crazy, and if they get too many passengers, they just shunt off the extra passengers to SAA, who have to take them at a discount. You know, the leftovers,
in other words.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
It's like that Sunday lunch where everybody's had the first round and then there's just the crap really that's left. Tell me, Tim.
Never had that experience.
Now, you are on your way up to Joburg later on, but you're in Cape Town most of the time. Is that right?
No, I stay in the Karoo. It's a very strange situation. I stay in a very deserted place in the Karoo. I'm about 40 k's from the nearest town.
That's nice. I'm almost jealous. What kind of decision is that to make? I mean, how did you come to the point where you were like, I've had enough of this. I can write in any place in the world, and you can. You decided to live in the middle of the Karoo.
Yeah, no, it's really odd. I mean, it's one of the joys I think about the new world is that really you can function pretty well from anywhere and in some jobs, you know.
Yeah, of course.
So we bought a piece of land. My wife and I bought a piece of land really a long time ago, and then we built a little cottage on it. And then we loved it so much, we decided that we were going to build a house. Then we had a house, and then we decided, let's move here. And we stayed here for about 3 years. And then after that, there was like some crisis in the office, and they needed an extra body, and then I was hauled back to Johannesburg. And I've been in Joburg for 5 years, and just at the beginning of this year, we came back down.
You said, to hell with this, I'm not going to do this anymore. Okay, so you're close enough to Cape Town, though, to know what's going on, and I suppose all of us these days, it doesn't matter where we are geographically, because the news is available to all, and thanks to the internet, we can keep a close eye on what's going on. Now, Patricia DeLille has obviously been in the news quite a lot. She's been unseated eventually. She's decided to get out of there. And Dan Plato is the new mayor. We know this name, though. He's been in the wings for a long time, right?
Yeah, he was once mayor of Cape Town previously, and he actually stood down in favor of Helen Zille. I mean, I just think it's fantastic to have, you know, a mayor named after a Greek philosopher. I mean, how unusual is that for South Africa? I mean, that's got to be good, right? You've got to like the person who's named after a philosopher.
Yeah.
Surely.
Especially Plato. We like a little stoicism. All right.
Yeah. No, he's interesting. I mean, the criticism about him is that he actually joined the National Party in, 1994. So, you know, the people have said, you know, democracy's just hit in South Africa. So who do you decide to join at that point? You decide to join the National Party.
Not the best move.
But people forget, you know, the National Party was at that point very dominant in the Western Cape. So if you were a career politician and you were looking to your future, strangely enough, weird as it might seem, the National Party was a big force in the Western Cape at the time. And it was predicted that they would win the provincial government, which they did.
Yeah, I remember that. And we've often forgotten that eventually the NNP, as it became, became part of the ANC. Didn't become part of the DA. They were in an alliance for a while. But remember that Martinus van Schalkwyk and company eventually joined the ANC.
Yeah, no, I know. I sort of, it was a kind of act of emulation. You know, the why they thought they would survive in the ANC, I have no idea. But anyway, they sort of joined the ANC and then in a typical way just disappeared. I guess that's what happens to you're only as powerful as the point at which you negotiate your entry. And as soon as you're inside the organization, well, then all of your power disappears.
It's almost like an ANC total victory. I mean, you even consumed your enemy at the end.
But
it is curious. So this guy, Dan Plato, I mean, does he carry any of those old NNP qualities into the mayor role now? I mean, what kind of a person is he? What do we know about his record?
No, his record is really is good, and he's been a sort of differential, you know, to the DA leadership. But his, you know, he was on the council at the time of the Soccer World Cup and did a good job, apparently. So his reputation as a politician is actually, he's fairly unknown, and he likes to keep a low profile. Which is rather odd until now. So my suspicion is the DA was looking for somebody who wouldn't be Patricia DeLille.
Yeah, well, that pretty much leaves 99.9% of all people on earth except Patricia DeLille. and they can't go back with her. That's been a spectacular fallout. People are saying that she might join the ANC. Do you think that's possible?
No, I don't think so. There was a rumor that she asked the ANC for a diplomatic post. I think that it's much more likely. You know, in KZN, the ANC sort of helped foster the sort of rival to Inkatha, which sort of sat outside of the party, but sort of voted for the ANC. My guess is that's what their plan is for Patricia de Lille as well.
They'll start a vehicle like the NFP that can kind of pretend to be against them, but eventually give them votes.
Exactly. We'll just divide the opposition vote. That's the if you're in a proportional representation system, then the party with the highest proportion wins. So it's always nice to have your opposition's vote split. So I think they will quietly support her, or maybe overtly. We have yet to see, but I'm sure they'll support her financially.
So listen, this week has been an incredible week in Parliament while we're talking about the politicians, because we've seen Malusi Gigaba's sex video discussed. We've seen various issues around the VBS bank brought up. We've seen some fisticuffs. What's going on there? Is Parliament more interesting than it's been in a while?
I mean, it's always interesting. I mean, you know, when I was on, I actually worked in Parliament for a bit. I mean, it's a sort of conflation of the politics of the nation, you know. And to me, the fisticuffs that happened this week, you know, they are sort of reflection of people's frustration with each other. You know, I sort of oddly wondered whether they shouldn't formalize it somehow, you know, and have a rollerblading ring or something, you know. But I mean, it is depressing that logical argument just doesn't seem to be enough.
No, it has to get violent, it has to get ugly, it has to be rude, it has to insinuate all kinds of nastiness.
Exactly. I mean, it just seems to be a characteristic of politics all around the world now that it's a question of ego and identity, and politics just seems to have lost its way. I mean, I thought that when, you know, after the Zuma period, Parliament would calm down, you know, that there wouldn't be the standing rows and the, you know, order, you know, shouting just continually, you know, but that kind of attitude by politicians to the parliamentary forum is it seems to have become ingrained now. It seems to be part of what we expect from Parliament.
You know,
and I suspect it's getting worse, you know, because, as the election gets closer, people get more and more determined to make their voices heard and so on.
Tim, you know what? I was listening to David Makura speaking yesterday on a number of issues in Gauteng, and he said something that I thought was quite interesting. He pointed out that government revenues are declining, and he said declining, as if to highlight the point. And then I thought a little bit while you were talking now about what you're saying about how politics, there's a desperation in politicians at the moment. They're screaming, "I'm relevant. I'm still here. You still need me." But I wonder how long the curve is going to give these politicians to remain relevant. I mean, we know that in South Africa there are so many municipalities that just don't function at all. People are used to living in an anarchy in some ways. And I'm wondering whether or not these guys are going to ultimately disintermediate themselves. Like so much other stuff has happened in a world that's technologically connected like never before, where everything is a return on investment. People are able to measure things accurately. We can talk stuff through in a very connected, interlocked, interwoven way. And I'm wondering whether politicians and this old idea of electing people to go and sit in a chamber and talk is the way to do stuff. Do you think that they may be a little desperate and that this is what's happening in politics? You see Donald Trump in America. You see this populism in Europe. You see all these things going down, and here in South Africa, our politicians are screaming to be noticed.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, in South Africa, I think it's easy to explain because it's obviously not easy, but you know, in my mind, at least, the South Africa's problem is that, you know, we've just run out of money. You know, the one very surprising thing about the ANC during the first 15 years or so was that they actually ran the government finances very responsibly. You know, and I wouldn't have anticipated that, you know, in the early years of the ANC administration, this is a socialist government, they would be, you know, there would be incredible demands on the fiscus. You know, you would expect that they would, you know, that they'd have to give in to these demands. They did, actually, by the way. There was South Africa's level of moving money from the wealthy to the poor via the government is, you know, one of the highest in the world. I mean, but nevertheless, I think that, you know, during the Jacob Zuma period, what happened was that business just got hutful.
Yeah. That's a good word.
Started trying to find ways to expand outside the country. And that's left politicians now, you know, with no room. There's nowhere to go. They can't borrow any more than they are, or they can't borrow faster than they are at the moment. And that makes them, you know, when people come to them and ask them for projects and for money to buy Gautrain, you know, to build new stations and so on, the government just has to say no.
They don't have any more. The trough is empty, basically.
Yeah, no, exactly. I also think that's why there's so much corruption, strangely enough. I think people realize that this gravy train, you know, is going to end up crashing. So the best thing to do is to try and grab what you can now, whatever, you know, whatever the consequences.
Yeah.
You know, this hose pipe is going to be turned off, you know.
The gravy's going to run out.
But, you know, about the broader point about disintermediation and politicians, I think that's so interesting. The political system is based on this notion of elected trust. You vote for politicians, you trust them to act in your interest, right? But what if they don't? What holds them to that?
Well, these days, don't we think that maybe these days there's a chance that there could be some real-world consequences in a way that there wasn't really before? Because ordinary people have means of communicating like they didn't before. Ordinary people have means of organizing like they never did before. And while we can decry and complain about so much in terms of social media, it does appear to me that there's new opportunity for people to find new ways to have themselves represented and taken note of by the systems that weren't there before. They just weren't there. You had to hope that someone who was representing you would do the best job they could. There was no way to hold their feet to the fire.
Yeah, you know, somebody made this really great point, I thought, about American politics. They said, you know, one of the interesting things about American politics is that a succession of politicians has mastered the media of the moment. So if you look to you know, when radio was happening in America, FDR used to have things called fireside chats, and every Friday he was on the, you know, he used to speak for an hour and a half about, you know, what was happening in politics. When television had its heyday, JFK was, you know, you had to be good looking and have hair and,
yes,
you know, be presentable on television. You know, he was a television personality. And now the medium of the moment is social media and the internet, and actually the master of that is Donald Trump. You know, you can like him or hate him, but there's no denying that he really has mastered that medium.
Yeah, he's the troll. So, he's the troll that won the White House.
Yeah, no, exactly.
CliffCentral.com.